end of it. It's just a historical figure. No. We've got lessons we can learn from everything in the Bible. None of it is filler. None of it is just wasted space. And whoever we study in the Bible, we can see character traits that we can see evident in ourselves or evident in other people. Or character traits that other people can see in us that sometimes we don't think. If we can look at these people in the Bible and pick out some character traits, good or bad, don't think that people that know you and are around you can't look at you and pick out the same character traits, whether good or bad. So when we're looking at these people, we're examining them, understanding that we're under the same examination in life. You know, we don't have to say, well, people shouldn't judge me. You need to go find a different occupation. Go to find a different place to live, because people, we judge each other all the time. Now, we don't always communicate or verbalize those judgments, but we're making these judgments all the time. And as we read people, every time you're reading your Bible, you're passing judgment on. You read about somebody doing something and say, how in the world could he do that? Didn't he know that was going to turn out bad? Or you read something and say, boy, good for him. He finally got that thing right. We're making those judgments all the time. So as we look tonight at Pontius Pilate, obviously we're not going to come out impressed. We're not going to come out in a positive light. But we also learn that there's a lot of people in a position just like him tonight that know the right thing to do, but outside pressures overrule their common sense, and they make a bad decision and then spend eternity paying for it. What a sad thing. So there's traits in all these fellows. John chapter 19, verse 19, and Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross. And the writing was, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. This title then read many of the Jews, for the place where Jesus was crucified was nigh to the city, and it was written in Hebrew and Greek and Latin. We're looking tonight at Pontius Pilate. There's so much. Luke chapter 23, John chapter 18 and 19, Matthew chapter 26, 27. There's so much there. We can go through his whole life and his whole story. But we're going to take this one saying that he wrote and put at the head of the cross, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews, and we're basically going to look at Pilate's character through this one statement that he wrote. From this one short statement he wrote, we're going to find a wealth of information about him, about his attitude, about what he thought, about how he felt, and about where he spent eternity. All from a short phrase like that. Last week we looked at Caiaphas, the high priest. You remember Caiaphas was the highest Jew. He was a government appointee. He was appointed by Herod to oversee the Jews in their religious and domestic affairs in Judea. And he was the Jew that was ultimately responsible for crucifying Jesus Christ. He was the last one to see him that delivered him to Pilate to be judged. So from that ultimate authority in Jewish stature, now he goes to Pontius Pilate, who again is a government appointee by Herod, but he oversees not the religious and the domestic affairs of the Jews, he oversees jurisprudence. He oversees the civil and social aspect, and his job was to keep peace in Judea. Among 7 million Jews and all the Romans, because this is a Roman territory, he was responsible to keep the peace and keep the quellings down and keep the noise down so that nothing got to the ears of Herod, that there was disturbances in that area. So he's got all of this responsibility put upon himself. And as he writes on Jesus' cross, as Jesus is crucified, as we go to the end of the story, he writes that title in the three languages. In Hebrew, which is the religious language of the day. In Greek, which was the common language, the spoken language of the day. And in Latin, which was the legal language of the day. So in all these three languages, they read the same thing. And we read it in English, our language for today. Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Look, if you would, back at Matthew 26. The name Pilate appears 56 times in the Gospels and Acts, and then one time in 1 Timothy where it just pops up, where it says that Jesus Christ before Pontius Pilate gave a good testimony. But mainly he appears in the Gospels and then a reference in Acts. But the only time we get a title for Pilate is in Matthew chapter 26. Maybe it's 27. I didn't write down my reference here. Yes, 27. Matthew chapter 27 and verse 2. And when they had bound him, being Jesus, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. This is the only time in all the times that Pontius is named that we get an official title put to his name. And his name is governor. Now, we think of governor in our judicial system. We kind of understand the realm. The governor of the state of Ohio would be under the authority of the president of the United States. So Pontius Pilate is under the authority of Herod the king. And the biblical term for him is governor. Now, the historical term for him was procurator. Pontius Pilate was the procurator of Galilee. Now, in Webster's dictionary, it simply says that a procurator is a manager of others' affairs. A manager of others' affairs. Now, here's why I think it's interesting. We so often in Bible study find terms that are not biblical. And I want to pause here just for a minute to kind of remind ourselves that we need to be careful. In studying for the crucifixion, here's a word I ran to over and over again. The Sanhedrin delivered Jesus to be crucified. The Sanhedrin put him on trial. You know the word Sanhedrin is not in the Bible anywhere. It's not a biblical term. So when you hear somebody using the word Sanhedrin, they didn't get that from the Bible. They got that from reading references and sources about the Bible. And there's nothing wrong with that. But we so often quote references and other things that a lot of times we think stuff's in the Bible that's not in the Bible. And so when we read about him, you know, when I'm studying stuff and reading commentaries, everybody's calling him the procurator. I can't even say that word right. They keep calling him by that title. I'm thinking, well, you know, where in the Bible? There's got to be somewhere. So I looked up in the concordance, and I'm looking for all the references. Where is he called it by a title? And that's the only place in the Bible he's given a title, and it's not that. It's governor. And so we understand his position was a position of leadership. It was a position, he was like a chief magistrate over the realm of Judea with all the Romans and all the Jews and the intermingling between them. He had to oversee and he had to keep peace among all those people. Now his realm was not as good as like when we think a governor of Ohio. His realm wasn't that big. But he had specific control over that region to make sure that there was peace and that no uprisings happened under his watch. Let's look at Pontius Pilate tonight, the governor of that area of Judea, and see why he wrote what he wrote. He wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Let's notice, first of all, in our outline tonight, the people he despised. You'll notice on our outline, as I gave it to you, we use that same title that's written on the cross, but in each of these 4 points, we're emphasizing a different section of that title. And we say the people he despised, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. All right, you see that the Jews is in bold print there at the end of it. The Jews were a proud nation. Long before Rome ever became anybody, the Jews had been around. The Roman Empire didn't start till slightly before Christ. And it didn't go real long, depends on what history you read and all that kind of stuff, but it lost its power shortly after. But the Jews were there before, and the Jews are still there now. When you talk about Romans now, you know, you're talking about Italians, but you don't really talk about Romans, not like they were back in that day. They were the power that was on the earth, but they were the new kids on the block, if we can say it that way. They had sprung up into world dominion and power. The Babylonians and Assyrians had been before them, and others would come after them. And so for their little brief window, which just happened to coincide with the birth and the arrival and the life and the crucifixion of Christ, the Romans were in power. And when they thought about the Jews, they thought, you know, when he said, Jesus is Nazareth, the King of the Jews, you have to understand the attitude of the taste in his mouth when he said it. He was the King of the Jews. Just like an anti-Semite would say it today. Jesus was the king of the Jews. I mean, what's that? What's to that being the king of the Jews? I mean, who cares? And that was the attitude of Pilate when he wrote it. It's not like Pilate was getting brownie points or Pilate was acknowledging something. Pilate, when he wrote that title over the head of Jesus, was going after the Jewish people by saying, hey, he's nothing more than a king of you people. What good is that going to do? Who is he going to be? What is the king of the Jews going to do? Notice, number one, the Romans measured a man by his might. The Romans measured a man by his might. You know what we think of when we think of Romans? We think of the ones in the military garb. We think of the centurions. We think about those in the Colosseum. And you didn't have respect in Roman citizenry, and your respect was based on your power. It was based on your strength. The men that excelled were the ones that had power. Unless they were a Julius and born into, you know, a Caesar and born into that, the way you climbed the ladder was by your might. That's why so many Roman centurions, so many Roman leaders, so many even the dictators themselves were just cruel. They were just cruel people. Nero is the one that took the Christians and had his palace and had the long walkway, according to history, had the long walkway that led to his palace, the long path that was there. And he used Christians and set them on fire at night to light the pathway to his palace. And he didn't think anything about it. Nero was insane. And so these leaders, these Roman leaders, everything was in power. Everything was in might. That's why Jesus had an appeal to the Romans, at least for a time. Here's a guy that they heard could say, peace be still, and the storm calmed, and the sea waves laid down. That was something to notice. Here's a guy they heard that could touch the coffin, and the young boy could be raised to life again. Or he could go to the tomb and say, Lazarus, come forth, and he that was dead came forth, wrapped in grave clothes. That got the Roman attention. Somebody that could do those kind of things. Then when they heard about him standing in Matthew chapter 23 in front of the religious leaders of the day who the Romans despised, they despised the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They didn't give them much heed. They just thought they were a bunch of money-grubbing religious leaders. And the Romans, when they heard about Jesus getting up and saying, you bunch of hypocrites, you whited walls, you go out and make a proselyte, make him twofold more the child of hell than yourself, for the Romans, that got attention. And had Jesus come in that kind of might and power, he probably would have garnered some attention. But he didn't come in might. And so the Romans despised him. Hey, he's just a Jew. Remember in Luke chapter 23, verse 8, it says that Herod desired to see Jesus for of a long season. He desired to see some miracle done by him. The Herods, the Romans, wanted to see Jesus simply because they thought he had some power, some might. And that would impress them. But when he came into Jerusalem riding on that Palm Sunday, how did he come in? On the back of a white stallion, riding in glory with armies around him? No, he came on the back of a donkey with his disciples waving some palm leaves, and the Romans just look at that and laugh and say, that's it? That's your king? That's your power? So that's what Pontius Pilate is thinking when he puts Jesus of Nazareth, king of the Jews. That's their king? That's their power. That's their might. But notice this, number two. The Jews measured a man by his money. The Romans measured a man by his might. But the Jews measured a man by his money. Now, the Jews have had some military heroes in the past, haven't they? A 12-year-old boy with a sling. You think that impressed the Romans? How about Gideon with a bunch of lanterns and pitchers and trumpets up on the hill? See, all of Israel's military conquests were never really with a great military leader. Now, they had Joab, they had David for a time, but most of their, you know, their military history was not much that you would write volumes. You know, you can go get books on Roman military history. Jewish military history is pretty sparse. Kind of like great Jewish athletes of the 20th century. Ever heard people talk about books? There's not a whole lot in there. I like Julian Edelman. from the New England Patriots. You know, you know who that is. He's a Jewish guy, and he's a great, great football player. But there's not a lot of them in Jewish history. All right, so the Romans are despising this kind of people. They don't have anything. Their only goal is money. That's why when you get to the New Testament, you hear Jesus speaking so many times to the Jews about money. Remember when we studied in the book of Luke on Wednesday nights, we found five rich men? How many times do you read about a poor man or a poor beggar? All right, the Gospels are all full of illustrations that are valuing people according to their monetary status or their monetary gain. You cannot serve God and mammon. All right, then the Bible goes on to tell us later that the love of money is the root of all evil. Why? Because to the Jew, that was the system. That's what they valued. That meant everything to them. That's why the Jewish leaders are in the temple twice when Jesus had to turn over the tables and making a profit off religion, because that was their goal. That's how they measured a person, by their wealth. So to the Romans, that didn't mean anything. What did it mean if you had some money, but you're a wimp? What did it mean if you had some money, but you weren't a man? So Pontius Pilate despised the people, and he said, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Second of all, we see the place he derided. That's a different kind of word, derided. D-E-R-I-D-E-D. The place he derided. Jesus of Nazareth. All right, it's enough that he's the King of the Jews. I mean, so what? Who's that? The King of the Jews. Now he's also saying, Jesus of Nazareth. If you could, you know, you can hear the taste in his mouth when he says, the King of the Jews. Well, it's the same thing when he says, Jesus of Nazareth. If he'd have said, Jesus of Rome, don't you know that very title would have elevated, in his mind, elevated Jesus way up there? If he would have said, Jesus of Athens, that would have put him, in their view, put him up. So even if they'd gone Jewish and said, Jesus of Jerusalem, that title would have meant something. But it wasn't that. It was Jesus of Nazareth. Nazareth. I don't know what we compare it to around here, because I'm afraid to pick on anybody. I won't say Dogtown. I won't say anything. I won't even name any place. But it's just that place where you said Nazareth, the taste in your mouth, you said, what? Where? Not Rome, not Athens, not even Jerusalem. Jesus of Nazareth? Who's that going to impress? What's that going to mean to anybody? That's why Peter, in preaching in the beginning of the book of Acts, used that phrase constantly. Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus of Nazareth, approved by God by wonders and signs and miracles. Peter used that name over and over again. Because if those people hearing it really wanted to repent of who they crucified, they had to acknowledge who it was. They had to humble themselves. It was Jesus of Nazareth. Notice, number one in our outline, it was a place detested by the Romans. A place detested by the Romans. Galilee was the least of all the provinces of Rome. I'll pick it. This is the Detroit of their day. All right, last time I went with my brother to a ball game up in Detroit, and we walked downtown, I looked around and I said, this place is a mess. This place is deserted. It's a disaster. We grew up in the 60s and 70s around there, and it was a vibrant auto industry town. Now it's vacant. It's just run down. It's ruined. In fact, the last time, a couple of years ago, I went up there for a baseball game. We had to park in a different place because they were filming a movie in downtown Detroit. And it was, I think, the latest Transformers movie at that time. And they picked Detroit because they needed a place that looked like the apocalypse. They needed to find a place that looked like, you know, Armageddon had already happened and it was nothing but wiped out everything. And they picked downtown Detroit. Just a place that was run down and, you know, just Nazareth was not like that, but Nazareth was just that place that nobody went to. And you didn't tell people you were from there because that wasn't going to impress anybody. So it was a place detested by the Romans. Of all the provinces, it was the least. In fact, the fact that Pilate was the governor of Nazareth, the governor of that region of Galilee, was kind of humiliating in itself. He didn't have a high and lofty, but he wasn't the governor of Los Angeles or California. He was the governor of Judea, which was Galilee and Nazareth, all this realm down here. That was the bad place to be. In fact, it was that very place that turned out people that the religious leaders said, these are unlearned and ignorant men. They're from Galilee. Nazareth was the city in Galilee. So it was a place that the Romans detested. They looked down on it. Second of all, it was a place despised even by the Jews. Not only did the Romans look down their nose at it, they're Jews and they're in Nazareth. But you remember what Nathanael said in John chapter 1 when Philip introduced him? Philip said, we have found him, the Christ. Nathanael said, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Even the Jews looked down their nose at people that came from Nazareth. So when Pilate put the heading over Jesus' cross, it said, Jesus of Nazareth, he wasn't bragging on him. He wasn't elevating him. He wasn't exalting him. He was digging at the Jews. Yeah, he's your king, and he's from Nazareth. He's not even from, you know, some major city, some metropolis, some intellectual or educational place. He's from all places. He's from Nazareth. What's that? It's a broken down little town where people are working their fingers to the bone just to try to get by. Jesus of Nazareth. Letter C. The person he disowned. The person he disowned. Here it's Jesus. When Pontius Pilate thought about Jesus, number one, it is evident Jesus was sinless. Look in John chapter 18. John chapter 18, and again, we don't have time to look at all the text, but Jesus is brought before Pontius Pilate for judgment. And you know what Pilate says three times. In John chapter 18 and verse 38, Pilate says to Jesus, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out unto the Jews and saith unto them, I find in him no fault at all. He knew Jesus had not done anything wrong. Not anything of punishment. Even an unsaved Roman political appointee, a governor, when he came face to face with Jesus, with all he'd heard about him, and now seeing him one-on-one and questioning him and standing before him, came to the conclusion, you know, there's not a one of you that if Pontius Pilate examined you for 15 minutes would come out and say there's no fault in you. We wouldn't stand that test. That's just a human test. But Pontius Pilate said about Jesus, I find in him no fault. The key is, at all. Then he says down in chapter 19 in verse number 4, a second time, Pilate therefore went forth again and saith unto them, behold, I bring him forth to you that ye may know that I find no fault in him. That's the second time Pilate said it. This is not going over the first time again. This is the second time he said it. He talked to Jesus once and said, I find in him no fault at all. He came out the second time. I find no fault in him. Then the third time, verse 6, when the chief priests therefore and officers saw him, they cried out saying, crucify him, crucify him. Pilate saith unto them, take ye him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him. Three times Pilate says, this man's innocent. He's done nothing wrong. It is Pilate who makes the final decision on what's going to happen to Jesus. And he knows he's sinless. He knows he's not done anything wrong. He knows that for envy they have delivered him. He knows what's going on right here. Just when you and I read this story, we're not reading anything Pilate didn't know. And he knew what was going on. He knew that the Pharisees and the Sadducees had delivered Jesus because he was stealing the crowds from them. It says, for envy they had delivered him. Pilate knew all this, and he interviewed him, and he said, I find in him no fault. These Romans that were not easily impressed by any Jew, and not any Jew from Nazareth, yet he knew there was something special about this man in front of him. And he said, I find no fault in him. It was evident Jesus was sinless. Number two, it's evident Pilate was spineless. That's the best word I could come up with. It's evident that Pilate was spineless. He knows Jesus is innocent. It's kind of like people today that know Jesus was the Son of God. They know He was a mighty man that did miracles. But they don't take it any farther. They don't act on what they know. They don't pursue Him based on what they know. Pilate was the same way. He knew, but he's ultimately going to shut the door on what he knows and go a different direction. Just like a lot of people today. They're afraid to cross that threshold. They can give any reason they want to, but you know what it is? It's fear. They're afraid to commit. You know, a lot of folks will say this when it comes time to get saved. Well, I'm just afraid I couldn't keep it. And of course, you and I know the answer. Of course you can't keep it. It was up to you to be able to keep it. You could have done it in the first place, and then he wouldn't have had to do it. But a lot of people come to the threshold, know who Jesus is and realize it, but they're not going to walk through it. They're not going to cross that line. They back off. That's exactly what Pilate does. And the reason he does is because he's spineless. Look at John chapter 19. Look down at verse number 12. Look at verse 11. John 19 and verse 11. Jesus answered, "Thou couldst have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore, he that delivered me unto you," who is he? Right? You can say, well, it's Judas Iscariot. Yeah, it was, but you know who it was? It was Caiaphas that we looked at last week. He's the one that delivered Jesus to Pilate. "He that delivered me unto thee hath a greater sin," verse 12, "and from thenceforth Pilate sought to release him." All right, here's Pilate three times. He's innocent. He's innocent. He's innocent. He stands before him. I'm going to let him go. I know he's innocent. I'm going to let him go. Look over at Acts chapter 3. Acts chapter 3. This is long, this not long after. This is shortly after that story, of course, and Peter is preaching. And in Acts chapter 3 and verse 13, Peter is preaching. He said, "The God of Abraham and Isaac and of Jacob, the God of our fathers, has glorified His Son Jesus, whom ye delivered up and denied Him in the presence of Pilate when he was determined to let Him go." What does that tell you about Pilate? He was determined to let Him go. What do we know about Pilate? I find no fault in him at all. I find no fault in him. I find no fault in him. He knew he was innocent. He's determined to let him go. He's the governor. There's nobody there with any higher authority than him. If he's determined to let him go, he can let him go. Notice in Acts 13, notice that this is so wonderful. The end of verse 13, when he was determined to let him go, the first word of verse 14, but. Go back to John chapter 19. Back to John chapter 19 and verse 12. This is a good cross-reference. You might want to write that next to that verse in John 19. Write Acts chapter 3 and verse number 13. Back to John 19 and verse 12. From thenceforth Pilate sought to release him. Notice the next word. But. Do you know anybody that finds an excuse for not doing the right thing? Do you know anybody that hasn't found an excuse for not doing the right thing, including you, at one time or another? You know what Pilate's problem was? He's just like us. You know, we said, boy, I wish I could have been alive back in Jesus' day. How'd you like to have been Pontius Pilate? How'd you like to have been, oh, if I'd have been him, I would have, yeah. You think you had more intestinal fortitude back then than you do right now? How are we doing right now when it comes to taking a stand for Jesus Christ? How are we doing right now when it comes to putting ourselves out there for Him? Here's a man, I remember when I first got saved, I heard Dr. Ruckman preach a sermon, Pontius Pilate, the man in a mess. And I've always remembered that title because he was the first one to ever be between a rock and a hard place. Because here he is, he knows he's innocent, but he's got pressure coming. He knows he's innocent. He's determined to let him go. But he's got those Pharisees and Sadducees and the Jewish people yelling at him and saying, if you don't do something, you're not Caesar's friend. And he's in a mess. And there's a lot of people just like him today that know the right thing to do, but political expediency or peer pressure or saying, well, you know, if you don't do this, you're not my friend. And they go the wrong road instead of the right road, just like Pilate. He's not that much different from most of us. We just want to think that we're a lot better than he was and that we wouldn't have done what he did. I thank God I wasn't alive back then, that I'm alive when I am alive and I'm saved. And I don't have to worry about any of that stuff. I'll take this anytime over any of that. All right? It's evident he was spineless. He was determined to let him go. The person he disowned. He had Jesus in front of him. He had every opportunity to do right. And like so many others, he let the opportunity pass him by. And he did wrong. Number four, letter D. The prince he denied. We've talked about the king of the Jews. We've talked about Jesus of Nazareth. We've talked about Jesus. Now we say Jesus of Nazareth, the king. That's the prince he denied. The king of the Jews. Number one, instead of having Jesus crowned, he had him crucified. Instead of having Jesus crowned, he had him crucified. It was in Pilate's authority to declare him innocent and to let him go. And he could have done so and answered to nobody. Yeah, Herod. But Herod wouldn't have cared one way. As long as the people didn't revolt and all that, he wouldn't have cared one way or the other. It was in his power to say, I find no fault in him, to determine to let him go and say, here's what I'm going to do. You have one released. I'm going to give you Barabbas, or I'm going to give you Jesus, and Barabbas is going to be crucified because after all, he's guilty of insurrection. This is what I'm going to do. You don't have any say in it. And he'd have been completely within his legal realm and everything would have been fine. But he didn't do it. Instead of crowning him, he crucified him. He sent him to Herod, and if you remember the story, again, we didn't have time to go through all this. When Herod got Jesus, he was desirous to see him of a long time because he wanted to see some miracle done. And when it became obvious that Jesus wasn't going to do any miracle, he mocked him and he put a purple robe on him. And he mocked Jesus as a king. Then he sent him back to Pilate, who had sent him to Herod. When Pilate saw him like that, he gave him to his soldiers, and Pilate's soldiers then made a crown of thorns and put it on his head and gave him a reed and put it in his hand, all to mock him. He had the ability to crown Jesus king. You know, when he wrote this thing, the king of the Jews, that wasn't him acknowledging Jesus and who he was. That was him mocking the whole situation, mocking the Jews and mocking Christ. Instead of having him crowned, he had him crucified. It was going to happen. Look over at the book of Acts chapter 2. Here's where we get into the realm of our predestination or predetermination or whatever you want to call it. Chapter 2 of Acts in verse number 22. Peter again preaching this on the day of Pentecost. You men of Israel, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth, again, that's the term Peter liked to use, a man approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs, which God did by him in the midst of you, as you yourselves know, verse 23, him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, ye have taken by wicked hands, have crucified and slain. What does that say in verse 23? Being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God. What does that mean? It means that God had determined ahead of time that Jesus Christ was going to be a sacrifice for sin. God in his foreknowledge knew that when his son came, he would be rejected of men, he'd be nailed to a cross, he'd be crucified. God knew that was going to happen. But does that mean Pontius Pilate had to be the one to do it? No. Does that mean Judas Iscariot had to be the one to betray him? No. They had their own free will. It didn't have, it would have worked out that way anyways, but they didn't have to be involved. Pontius Pilate could have said, I'm not having anything to do with them, and maybe they'd have stepped in, they'd have gone back to Herod or something, and somebody else would have done it, but Pontius Pilate would have stepped back and been innocent of that blood. But he didn't. He didn't step back. He didn't crown him. He had him crucified. Number two, instead of exalting him, he executed him. Instead of exalting him, he executed him. Pontius Pilate had within his hands, within his ability, the power to let Jesus go. Now I know, you know, we can't rewrite history and we can sit here all night long saying, what if, what if, what if? But I know this. What if he hadn't done it? Would Jesus had another 10 years to minister? Okay, we can't open that can of worms. We don't know what would have happened. He still had to die for our sins. But Pilate would have walked away from the whole thing innocent. Not guilty with blood on his hands. But instead of exalting him, he executed him. You know, I don't think there's a place in here that Pilate didn't know what he was doing was wrong. There was no place in here he was struggling and fighting between right and wrong. He knew the whole time what he was going to do was wrong. But he knew the whole time what he was going to do. So he had him executed. I wonder what he thought when he heard that Jesus was hanging on that cross and darkness came over the earth for 3 hours. I know what Pilate thought. This isn't just any man. That one that he'd stood face to face with and was convinced that there was something about him, though he wouldn't acknowledge it. And then he hears there was darkness over the face of the earth and earthquakes. That was unknown at that time in that place. And that Jesus cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And his last words, it is finished. And the veil of the temple was rent from top to bottom. All these things happen, and none of that happens without Pilate knowing about it. And I wonder what the conviction was like in his heart after it's all over. There's no going back now. And all these things just point to the fact that he made the wrong decision. Instead of exalting him, he executed him. Then the story 3 days later that Jesus was gone. His body wasn't in the tomb. Not only that, but the rumor was that the graves of all the other dead in Christ had been opened too, and they'd walked around Jerusalem for 40 days before they ascended back to the Father with Jesus. And Pilate's watching all that. It's got to be like being in the middle of a horror movie. When Jesus rose from the dead bodies of the saints raised with him, according to Scripture, and walked through Jerusalem. Jeremiah, Daniel, I don't know which ones were there. But Pilate's hearing about all this stuff that happened because he crucified Christ. And his punishment, while he's still alive, is just getting worse and worse and worse. Lastly, number three, instead of following his conscience, he followed the crowd. Instead of following his conscience, he followed the crowd. He knew who Jesus was. He knew the right thing to do. You remember the story, we didn't look at it. His wife, while he was sitting there in judgment with Jesus, his wife came and called him aside and said, have nothing to do with this just man, for I've suffered many things in a dream because of him. And if it wasn't enough for Pilate with his own conscience, now his wife's saying, Don't mess with this guy. Don't have anything to do with it. So he goes out there and ceremonially washes his hands, saying, I am pure of the blood of this man. Thinking that was going to alleviate his responsibility. That was going to eliminate what he was about to do. That was going to cover up his wrongdoing. There's a movie that I saw when I got saved called... I forgot what the name of the movie was. The Burning Hell. Made way back in 1975. And in that movie, it's showing hell, and it shows Pontius Pilate in hell. 2,000 years after this. And this other fellow that gets down to hell's walking through there, and they're giving him a tour. You know, it's not all literal, you know, the way to buy. But the guy, and he sees this guy over there just wringing his hands, washing his hands. And he says, "Who is that?" And the demon or the devil down there tells him, "So that's Pontius Pilate." And he's still wringing his hands, still washing his hands, trying to get him clean from the blood that he shed. Why? Because his conscience told him it was wrong. But he yielded to the crowd. Isn't that just like a lot of folks today? Isn't that just like a lot of Christians today? Know what the right thing to do is, but boy, that peer pressure, that's what we call it. Instead of the crowd, we call it peer pressure. Trying to impress man instead of God. Pilate was just like that. Thank God we were never put in that situation. Thank God we didn't have that kind of authority and that kind of responsibility. You know, we look at people that have responsibility and authority and say, "Oh, I wish I had that." I'm glad I don't. With that responsibility comes, with that privilege and responsibility comes an accounting. And Pilate had a day of accounting for that. Can you imagine when he stands before Jesus again? He stood before him and three times said, "No fault, no fault, no fault." One of these days, according to Scripture, he's going to stand in front of him one more time. He's going to be taken out of hell at the great white throne of judgment and stand before Jesus Christ one-on-one, only to be cast into an eternal lake of fire. And he's going to go stand. At one time, Jesus stood before him in judgment. And he condemned Jesus. Next time, the tables are going to be turned. Next time, Jesus is going to stand a condemnment of him. But you know what? Jesus isn't going to condemn him. Pilate's going to condemn himself. Because he has not believed on the name of the only begotten Son of God. The Bible says, Jesus came not to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. He doesn't condemn us. We condemn ourselves when we don't believe on Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That was Pilate's problem. He was Caesar's friend, but he never became a friend of Jesus Christ. What a terrible opportunity passed up to know the right thing to do about Jesus Christ and not have done it. And yet, how many people today are in that same position? They know what they need to do with Jesus Christ, but they refuse to do it because of the crowd, because of people manipulating them, intimidating them. That's what happened to Pontius Pilate. And he paid for it with his soul. Let's stand together tonight with our heads bowed and our eyes closed.